you know, we live in a world where, oh my God, you've got something wrong with you, you have to get help for it, you know. So it's a different world now. But, you know, I'm equipped, I guess, not just to survive, but it doesn't matter what situation I'm in, I'm not scared anymore.
Brave, bold, brilliant. I'm here today with Sir Marco Robinson. Now, Marco, you've got a lot going on. You're a business coach, you're a social media coach, you're a top Netflix producer, best-selling author. Anything else? Because I know you like to
number
keep it
one, humble. Number one best-selling author, entrepreneur of the year, host of the Channel 4 TV show Get a House for Free. I have 180 feature films in development, 43 in distribution, and I have my own charity called Freedom X to help end homelessness. There you go.
Excellent. You see, there's a reason why you're on this planet, Marco.
Yeah, clearly.
Fantastic. Yeah, no, it's brilliant, actually, because I actually saw you a little bit on Clubhouse. You were on Clubhouse for a while.
Oh, yeah, 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 when it was trending, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's probably where I first came across your name. And then, obviously, it's great to be here today recording a podcast. So, yeah, this is really cool. So, Marco, do you want to start off with, I know you mentioned about homelessness and how important that is for you, and I know that's coming from a very personal place, but do you want to start there for us, and then we'll dig into all of kind of how your journey's evolved and all the great things that you've been doing since. So that'll be helpful, I think, for context.
Yeah, sure. So homelessness is very close to my heart because I used to be homeless, and actually my mum was homeless and I was homeless with my mum as a young child. So when I was 2 years old, my mum left my dad. He was a gambling addict. So he spent all the money on basically gambling horses. And one of my earliest memories, I think I was about 1 year old, and I could smell cigar smoke. I could see the newspapers on the floor, and I could smell smelly feet, right? And now I know that was my dad studying the form of racehorses at the weekend, right? Because that's what he did. So, and it was such an acute issue that she had to leave him because she had no money left. So she was in, I think, Leicester at the time. She went to move to the north to live with a mum and a stepdad. And they had a pub. And she came to the doorstep in January with me in her arms. I was 2 years old. And her stepdad said, it's either me or them, to her mum.
Wow.
Now, her mum said, I'm very sorry, you can't stay. Now, it was January. It was snowing. We had nowhere to go. She had no one there she could rely on. So she was really at her wit's end. And she went to the only thing she knew how to do was go to the park. She went to the park. She found some shelter and literally was slept in the park. And after a couple of days, we nearly died, but we were taken in by strangers. Now, the reason her stepdad was so funny with her and the reason she was so terrified to go back to that place was because he sexually abused her since she was 4 years old. And in those days, it was massively the patriarch. So the guy said, told you what to do, and that was it. He had no choice, right? So because it was the patriarch, he used to ask her mum to have baths with her and stuff like that. It was pretty horrendous stuff. And when she was 12 years old, he put his hand on her breast and said, I didn't marry your mum for your mum. I married your mum to get to you. So you can pretty much understand how terrified she was, right? To even think about going back there. Anyway, so we were on and off homeless for quite a few years. She was a casual worker, no U degree or anything like that. Very intelligent, but never had an opportunity in those days. So I was going to different schools literally all the time. And I was very small. I had bright ginger hair. I mean, literally, it was orange. And I was very white. So I'd stood out literally everywhere I went. And I got bullied to shit everywhere, every school I went to. So I ran away from school all the time. And then she met my stepdad, who seemed to be the answer for her because he was so nice, had a good job, blah, blah, blah. But then he started beating her up and there was domestic violence and it was not pleasant. And as a kid, when you see that thing going on, when you come home from school and like there's violent arguments going on and stuff, you don't know what to do. So I used to run away from home a lot. I tried to fight him, but I was too young. And then eventually, long story short, when I was 15, she met a man that she's still with now. It was a happy ending. She fell in love. And I knew that at the time because I was pretty wise, right? So I said to her, go and live with him. I don't want to know. You go and live your life. I'll look after myself. So what I did is I went around the town and knocked on. I basically talked to the shop owners and said, listen, I'll clean your floor for £1 an hour. Some of them said no, but a lot of them said yes. So I got paid £1 an hour to clean floors, took pride in it, became the best floor cleaner in town, right? And I used to live, used to get the trust of the shop owners and get the keys to the shop. I used to live in the shop, in either the roof or the cellar. I lived in Woolworths a lot, right? But no one knew I was there. And that you call that now the hidden homeless, right?
Mm.
I did that for a few years to save up some money. Eventually got my own place. And then I got into direct sales. And that's really the first chapter of my life, in a sense. The first act.
Yes. Yeah. Wow. And you know, growing up with all of that around you, I mean, I don't even know if you can begin to describe how that might have affected you psychologically. You know, if you look back as an adult now and see how you are, you know, with everything you've achieved. But what elements from when you were a kid growing up in that environment have possibly not necessarily held you back, but have maybe had more negative impacts on you? And what are the aspects that have really propelled you forward? Because there's always two sides to an experience.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, there is. I mean, obviously, psychologically, it was very damaging for me. There's a lot of trauma there. And, you know, as you've probably studied childhood trauma, that you kind of learn to forget it and compartmentalize it. And because of that, I was scared of people. I wasn't very, very good at communicating, was terrible at communicating. I used to spend all the time on my own. I would not trust anyone, which definitely did not help me in life.
Mm.
And the other thing was that because I was bullied a lot, and actually overcame that, because there was one time when I was 15 and there was like 20 kids in a garage, my friend's garage, well, so-called a friend, and they had me in the middle of this circle and they kept passing me from each person, kicking and punching me. And it was going on and on and on. And eventually I saw red, lashed out. I don't know what happened after that, but the next minute I was running down the road chasing 20 boys saying, "Come on!" like this. So actually, I'm grateful that I was bullied, because I was grateful I had the opportunity to overcome it and fight back. So that was the flip side of that.
Mm.
I think today, you know, there's a lot of things thrown around like snowflakes and things like that. You know, we live in a world where, oh my God, you've got something wrong with you, you have to get help for it, you know. So it's a different world now. But, you know, I'm equipped, I guess, not just to survive, but it doesn't matter what situation I'm in. I'm not scared anymore, because I've been in very scary situations, you know?
Yeah, yeah, fascinating. I mean, and, you know, when you were actually then, you know, you obviously had a strong work ethic, you know, because you were talking about you would, you know, you'd graft, you'd clean those floors, you do it with pride. You obviously were quite clever around, well, actually, this is a roof over my head as well. So, you know, there's you were smart, you were savvy, you were street, and you were prepared to graft to kind of set yourself up. What was the next move after that in your journey?
So the next move was, I knew that I was in a very small town. I knew that I didn't belong in this town. I just hated being there. And I felt I was going backwards all the time. So someone came and offered me a job in Manchester selling timeshare on commission only. This was in the late 80s, right? I had no clue what timeshare was, but basically it was a product that was £10,000 for a week holiday for the rest of your life. You know, no one could see it. You had to sell it, right? So I'm like, okay, fair enough. And I was like, because I was so bad at communication, so shy, I was the worst salesperson the company ever had in the whole history of the company. And I didn't sell anything for 6 weeks, right? And my boss said to me, said, "Listen, Marco, if you don't sell anything in the next 2 years, we're going to have to fire you," right? Now, the internal narrative in my head before that moment, yes, I was in a big town. Yes, I was in a new job. But because I wasn't successful, my question was, why am I such a loser? Why can't I do this? Why is it so difficult? Why can't I get a break, right? And, you know, when you ask those kind of questions, it's a negative cycle and you go into very negative energy. And I was really sick and tired of it. So my boss said, "I'm going to fire you in 2 days. And there is no way that I wanted to go back to that town again and clean floors." So that was my standard. I would not tolerate that. So what happened is it triggered a question in my head that was a different question than before. And the question changed to, how can I be successful? And literally, it was a mantra. It became, I owned the question. And I was shouting it down the road, because I used to walk back home 5 miles, asking this question all the time. I used to play music, because I used to be a disco dancer as well in those times. I was like Northwest champion and all that. So I used to dance and ask this question. Anyway, the day after, I went to the office and the top salesperson came up to me and said, I'd never met them before. And he says, Marco, I've not spoken to you before, but you have so much potential. And I believe that you can be the best salesperson here. And I said, no way. He said, yes way. And the reason I believe that is because I used to be homeless, had no money, and I thought I was a loser. So thanks very much. No, but he said that and it was like an intervention. And I attracted that intervention by asking that question, how can I be successful, right? So he said to me, I'm going to help you out because someone helped me out that was like you. I'm going to give you a book that I read that he gave me that changed my life. And I want you to go home and read the book and don't do anything else. Just read the book. Now, I hadn't read a book my entire life from cover to cover. But because my life was on the line, I thought, well, I've got nothing to lose. So I went home and read the book and I read it 8 times in the night and literally didn't go to sleep. And in the morning, I was so in a different place. I shifted and pivoted my mind that I didn't give a crap about anything. Didn't care about losing. All I knew was that I believed in myself and I knew that anything was possible. And I knew for the first time in my life that I had to take responsibility for it. So I literally ran to the office and I was so hot and sweaty, they sent me home to get changed. I had to come back again after getting changed. And in those days, what happened is it was an office and they used to bring the prospects in to meet you in reception. And they brought these prospects in. It was a guy and a woman, both married, and they had a dog with them. And I thought, why have they got a dog? And I realized that he had a walking stick. It wasn't a walking stick, it was a white stick. And I thought, oh shit, they're blind. Mm-hmm. He's blind and she's blind. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, I'm going to sell them timeshare and they can't even see me. How the hell am I going to do that? So again, it was like a weak moment. But because I was galvanized by the book, I thought, what the fuck, right? I'm going to sell this. So I sat them down and said, listen, you're going to stay sat here with me for 4 hours. And at the end of it, you're going to spend £10,000 on timeshare because you're going to love it. And they said, no, we're not. We need to go now. We're not. We don't like this. So it was like a battle. And I was just going hell for leather because I believed in myself. And actually, I believed in the product because I'd seen people take holidays. So it was like 6 hours later. And I asked, you know, for them to buy it. And he looked at his wife and paused. He put his hand in his pocket. He got his wallet out. He gave me his gold credit card and said, listen, Marco, we love it. You were right. There's £10,000. Take it off my card right now. We can't wait to go. And I was like completely mind blown because that was the first success I ever had in my entire life, right? And I'm lost for words. And the first thing I said to them, why did you buy from me? you don't say that as a salesperson, right? So they said, this is your first sale? I said, yes, yeah, my first sale. They said, you're not supposed to say that. I said, I can't help it. I'm so excited. And they started laughing and crying and laughing. And they eventually said, listen, Marco, we can't believe it's your first sale. But as you ask, the reason we bought from you is because you transferred your belief to us. We could see ourselves taking those holidays. It was there. You changed our life. Thank you. That moment changed the rest of my life. I became a salesperson of the month, salesperson of the year, the most successful salesperson in the company, the youngest sales manager. I was managing 50-year-old guys. I was 22 years old. So the confidence and belief it gave me was astounding. And I did that for another 2 or 3 years and I got offered jobs all over the world. And I got a job offer in Malaysia in 1997 to run the company. And it was Malaysia, it was a long way from England. And I was married, I had a young baby and I decided what the hell, I'm gonna go there. So I ended up in Malaysia in 1997. That's part two of my story.
Excellent. Well, before we get to part two, we're going to hold the thought about Malaysia. That's cool. But, you know, there's so much value in what you've just said, isn't there, you know, in terms of, because the reason for this podcast is to help inspire others, right? Yeah. To push out of their comfort zone and believe in themselves. And what I love about that was, you know, the story, well, it's very heartfelt anyway, and you literally changed lives. But isn't it interesting how when you change your own mindset and perspective, the stuff comes to you, you know, you I believe as well, you raise your vibration, you attract things to you. And sometimes it's a bit weird and you kind of go, oh gosh, never, you know, that, how did that happen? But it did. But also I think that transferring of energy and belief and being able to literally paint a picture and a dream for a couple that couldn't see themselves, and you gave them the eyes and the potential, yes, through storytelling, through, yes, your energy, and you believed in the product. If you didn't believe in the product, I don't think you ever would have been able to sell it, because it would have been incongruent with your values and what's important to you, right? Yeah,
That's great,
fascinating.
Jeanette, because no one's ever come back to me with the insight that you've just given. So well done for that.
I've been round the block a bit, Marco, myself. So,
Definitely have. We'll have to have a conversation about your story very soon.
it isn't about me. But no, but I love that. I do love that because it shows that no matter how low you are in your life, no matter what your background or start has been, that if you can really harness that energy and internal power, anything is possible. Anything. So, I think that's a big lesson for anyone that's having a tough time, or maybe they've been dealt a bit of a shitty hand in life that was out of their control. Take the control back. And the other thing I loved you saying, Marco, was around owning it. Owning your life. I'm the CEO of my own life. I make the choices. It's down to me how I frame something or take action. So that ownership piece, Marco, talk about that a little bit more for me and where that has kind of continued to play out for you in other areas of your life where you've really owned something and then great things have happened.
Yeah, well, I think I was very fortunate to be homeless and very fortunate to be bullied and very fortunate to have a very, very traumatic childhood because that gave me a great lesson that no one's going to save me. No one's going to rescue me. No one's going to come and say, Marco, you're better than this. They weren't there. I didn't have a mentor. I didn't have a role model. I didn't have a coach. Now, coaches coming out of people's ears, right? So there was no help for me then. And, I didn't know how to ask for that. But I learned the hard way. So that was the essential part of that. But I didn't believe in myself. I knew no one was going to rescue me, but I didn't know how to get out of it. So I learned that basically there's only two triggers. There's only two points that get you to take massive action. One is desperation and one is inspiration. And I learned that because I was so fucking desperate, basically metaphorically pain, that pain made me take a lot of action, right? But I needed inspiration to see the vision or journey where I could go to pull me towards it. So I needed the pain to push me, but I needed the inspiration to pull me. So going back to when I was a child, I was 5 years old, and I was the kid at the back of the classroom looking out the window all day, pretending I was James Bond, pretending I was in the Far East, pretending I had all these gorgeous girlfriends. That was my imagination. So when I looked back at my life, I realized that I actually harnessed my imagination. And for me, that was real. And that was a far better place to be than it was in my real life situation. So I learned to live in my imagination and I was very good at accessing it. So for me, to answer that question, when I learned and real had the realization that actually your imagination is real, you just have to believe it, then I was able to make things happen for me that I would never ever have dreamed of before that moment. But actually, I've been dreaming of it before when I was a child. Does that make sense?
Absolute sense. And nowadays we talk about visualization, manifestation, and all these kind of fancy words around it. But essentially, it is it's dreaming and believing and seeing that kind of making that what's unreal real in your mind. And that's basically, isn't it? Visualization, manifestation. And I think that's great. And that power that children have, almost the innocence, isn't it, to escape into a fantasy world. As adults, if we can tap into a little bit of the child within us that can dream like that and not have all the noise and the blockers
Oh
around,
because
then that.
you unlearn that by conditioning in the environment, by education system, by your parents, by society. But a kid could put a box on its head and draw a little face on it and become a spaceman, it fucking believes it, right? So that's the difference, isn't it? Because a lot of people, everyone dreams, but they believe the dream is so far away, they don't take the action to actually get it because they don't believe they can get it. Now, I was a kid, I was dreaming it, but part of me was going, oh, maybe it's I can't do that, but I'm going to dream it anyway. I didn't have the strategy to get to say to myself, well, actually, you just have to take one more step and you're going to be closer. But if you believe your dreams are there, you just have to take an action, then you take the actions now to actually achieve it. And that's the key to a successful life.
Yeah, 100%, 100% agree with you. No, I love this conversation. It's great because it's just sort of reframing, making people think slightly differently. How can I unlock that inner child in me of that innocence of dreaming and actually then, as I suppose as an adult, take the action to make it happen. So, Marco, you ended up going to Malaysia, and at this point, you're in a much more senior position, right? you're running the business, are you? You're actually leading the business. You went to be the boss, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did that transition from being essentially a worker, a great worker, but you know, top salesperson, all of that, to running the shop? Because that is a leap, isn't it, for a lot of people to be fully.
Yeah, it was a leap because I was managing 20 people and going into a public company with thousands of people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I got there, my job was to run the hotel division and the timeshare division because they'd only just started that. But when I went there in 97, a lot of people won't remember this, but there was an Asian economic crisis caused by George Soros in 1997, where he devalued all the Asian currencies, right?
I remember very well as an economist, yes.
Yeah, well, there you go. So I was paid in Malaysian ringgit, and the Malaysian ringgit went to like 15 to the US dollar. It was 3. So they didn't have the money to actually pay me my salary. And I'm in this position with my six-month-old baby and my wife thinking, they can't pay me. And I'm in a 6,000 miles away, right? But there was an intuition there, was a gut feeling that there was a huge opportunity in this place because it was beginning of a business evolution in this particular industry. So what I did, I thought, right, I innovated the product from a week's timeshare into a points product so people could buy points and go away for 1 or 2 days instead of having to commit to a whole week. Once I did that, the price reduced, so it made it affordable. And then I started getting sales. I built a small sales team, and within a year, I had 3,000 salespeople working for me, telemarketers and salespeople, and we were doing 100 million in a year in sales. And I was making, although I was an employee, I was making $1 million a year then in 1997. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was amazing. But the other thing I didn't understand was the value of money. So when I was getting paid all this money, I spent it on crap, sports cars, going out, holidays. I didn't really invest it in the right way. I gave it to a financial advisor. That was the biggest mistake I made, right? So I had all this money coming in, but then I didn't have the investments to invest in because I didn't understand how to do that. So I did that for 3 years. I did $1 billion in sales. I broke the world record in the industry. And then 3 things happened to me. One, I was giving a seminar in the office and I collapsed and I had a heart attack. So I was taken to hospital, right? And they said, listen, you're okay, but you basically, this is because of stress. Because I was so focused on success that I sacrificed a lot of other things, like my family time, spare time, a lot. And when I was in hospital, I found out my wife was having an affair with my best friend. And I'd known my wife 10 years and my best friend 10 years. And I got him a job in the company that I was working at, and I just found out. And that was more painful than the heart attack because it was a double betrayal. And quite honestly, I didn't know. I lost my identity because I thought I wasn't worth anything.
Mm.
So how could 2 people betray me like that after what I'd done for them? That took a long time to process and eventually overcome. And because I had 2 small children, you know, my son was 1, my daughter was 3 years old. She asked me to come back every single week. And I said, no, I left. And after I think it was about 8 months, I went back to that relationship only because of the children, but it was one of the biggest mistakes I made. Mm. Because I went back into a relationship where I was emotionally divorced. Couldn't trust her ever again. But I was there for the kids and that was great, but the kids don't even remember those times. So it's like, why the hell did I do it? And then after that, I bought shares in the company I was working for. They did like an employee share offer, and I bought them for $3 and they came down to 10 cents. I lost everything in the share market. So I had about 50 grand in the bank left out of all of that, right? But that was good because it made me do the things I'm doing now. If I'd not have been through that, I would have gone back to corporate, even though I hate it, right? I still would have gone back there. And I decided in that moment, when those 3 things happened to me, there is no way that I'm ever going to have a boss again in my entire life. And like you just said before, I wanted to take my power back. And I felt I'd given everything and given so much to the company. I turned the company around, but I didn't get rewarded for it. So I quit the job. And then I set up shop on my own as a consultant. I got a few consulting jobs. It wasn't easy because when you go from an employee to getting a big salary to having no salary, you know what this is like. Think, shit, am I going to pay the mortgage here, right? Am I going to pay the bills, lab, and the school fees? Because the school fees were like thousands a month, private schools and all that. And yeah, it was really difficult. And I was consulting. I had a another job on the side. I started another business, and my wife wasn't supporting me. She was like moaning there wasn't enough money. She wouldn't reduce the bill. She wouldn't take the kids out of private school. So I'm like really going into this thing all in and getting some success. And I started doing motivational seminars. At my first event, I sold 1,000 tickets and did a like Tony Robbins thing. I thought, shit, this is amazing. So I thought I better do this more often. So I did. And then in 2008, I'm the unhappiest man I thought in the world. And I'm thinking to myself, how can I leave my wife?
How long had you been back with her then, Marco, after
6 years.
the 6 years?
Yeah, 6 years.
Yeah, it's a long time. Yeah.
Yeah, and to be fair, to be quite frank, I had an affair with a girl, and that was a good thing because it made me feel great about myself. It made me feel wanted. Do you know what I mean? And
Yeah.
I have regrets about that because of what happened, and that was a good thing. I'm actually still friends with that girl now. She's married, but we're still friends. It's amazing, right? So 2008 came, and as you know, what happened in 2008? Do you remember that, Jeanette?
2008, then well, there was a crash, right? Probably the whole
Subprime crisis
financial
happened.
market went, all fell out of the world, right? Financially, call from the US.
So I'm asking the universe, how can I leave this marriage? And the universe told me, Marco, write a book. So I sat down at 5 a.m. for 6 months and wrote my first book called Close the Deal and Suddenly Grow Rich, which has been updated. And it became a number one best-selling book. It basically became a sales classic, like a legend book all salespeople read. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. And I'm in the bookstore signing the books, going, wow, this is amazing. Because there's queues of people waiting to sign it, but the book didn't make a lot of money. So I thought to myself, how can I make $1 million from this book? And another idea from the universe came to me as a marker. What you need to do is look at the recession, look at your network, look at the hotel rooms that are not being used, ask a hotel if they can give you a free room if you send someone there for lunch. Because as you know, hotels make money more on the food and beverage. So I got like 500 free rooms from hotels. I put them in a voucher we call a vacation voucher and called it a 5 day, 4 night break, accommodation only. And I sold it to companies for $50, but they had to buy 100. And I started selling these vouchers to like Shell Oil, Petronas, BMW, Rolex, IKEA. And I'd made $12 million in a year doing this.
Because you asked the right question.
So I did that for a few years. Left my wife, met someone else, but I was so happy. When I left my wife, I was dating. It was an amazing time. And I eventually sold that company, and I got into property by accident, really, because I had all this cash. I thought, right, I don't want to make the same mistake as before, right? So I started buying subprime crisis 2010 houses in America for 20 grand and flipping them for 50 as a hobby. And my friend started saying, Marco, how the hell do you do that? Can you teach me? So then I thought, okay. So I started teaching people and made more money than I did with the other business, right? So I'm doing all these seminars all over the world, and I wrote my second book, The Financial Freedom Guarantee, which became another number one bestseller in 2016, right? And I'm buying property, and my cousin, one of my family members, said, come into business, we'll buy properties together. And then 18 months later, something very bad happened to me. We bought a building in Manchester, 50 apartments, and the building was condemned because the fire cladding was falling off. It was like Grenfell before Grenfell happened. And my cousin started embezzling money out of the company and his mum. And basically, the bank tried to take all the assets, and the loan was costing 50K a month. He was trying to embezzle everything from me. It was a nightmare, and pretty much I lost everything that I'd worked for.
Let me pause there, right? Because there's a you've had now two major betrayals, right? From people that are closest to, well, three actually. At that point, are you thinking, oh my God, what am I? Are you ever thinking, what am I doing? Is it down to me that I'm these people that are close to me are betraying me, stealing from me, taking my good nature and just sticking two fingers up to me and really ruining me when trying to be a good person that's, doing the right thing? Was there a part around what is it me?
Yeah, there was definitely a massive part of that, and I'll tell you what happened. It got to such a degree where the bank sent a letter of repossession to my mum's house in 2018. Now, that was the most painful to me because of what we'd been through. So she could be homeless and I could be homeless again. So it came to such a degree that I'd lost everything. I'd have betrayed again. My mum was going to lose a house. So I bought loads of pills and I swallowed them at the beginning of 2019 and tried to kill myself, right? And what happened then was, because it was so emotional and everything I'd worked for, thought, what's the fucking point, right? So I took the pills. I was staying in my mum's house. It was just the pandemic coming, blah, blah, blah. And she came in with the letter of repossession and she said to me, it was about an hour after taking the pills. She said to me, we can fight these bastards. And she completely inspired me. I went to the toilet, put my fingers down my throat. Luckily, they came back up again just in time. And then what I did is I basically fought the bank. I went on social media and called them out for the mistakes they made and the victimization. And I got a lot of support. And they tried to get, I think it was about £7 million from me. And I went to court and I won the case. And the bank lost. And I got all my assets back.
Wow.
Yeah, that was probably the I'm obviously feeling emotional now. I'm tearing up a bit. Because that was the end of my life, I thought. And I thought to myself, why do I always get into this situation, right? And of course, obviously, trust issues. I was like, well, they're my fucking family and they do this to me. But when I actually analysed it in the cold light of day, do you know what it really was that was causing this? It was jealousy. Mm-hmm. So my cousin, who'd known me all my life, I realised was always trying to be better than me and one-upping me. And when I was getting above him, like the Channel 4 TV shows 2017, at the peak of what I was on my journey, he was jealous. So he would do everything he could to sabotage and derail me, even if it meant that I'd fucking try and kill myself. So I learned he was a complete narcissist. And I didn't know what that was until then.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, listen, it's very raw and emotional. And my God, thank God your mum came in at exactly that moment. I mean, talk about a sliding doors kind of situation.
It was a sliding doors moment, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And your mum, that unconditional love of a mum, you know, that she had for you. And she probably didn't know you'd taken the pills.
No, she didn't know.
But maybe she, mother's intuition, just, you know, and there's something serendipitous about the timing of that, isn't there? And thank God that's the choice you made and she came in at exactly the right time when you needed that. But it's interesting what you were saying around your cousin, around other people. And very often, I think, when people, you know, maybe criticise or judge or try and throw you off track or they do things that, you know, to hurt you intentionally or unintentionally, 9 times out of 10, it's always about what's going on in their world, isn't it? You know, and actually sometimes it's hard to see that and you think that you've done something wrong. And actually it's not. It's just because they're messed up in their head. And actually this sort of, you know, comparing yourself to others, this jealousy, whatever's going on. But it's hard because then you have to part company with people in your life. Well, you don't have to, but it's probably quite smart to reduce or not have relationships with people that have done that to harm you. But it's hard, isn't it? And I think there's a big lesson there that it's nearly always about the other person. It's not actually that you've done anything wrong at all.
Yeah, exactly right. Because I was always innocent. I was always the good guy. I always wanted the best for people. I still, you know, I'm a coach because I love helping people. That's what I love to do. It fulfills me. Mm. But then I realize that a lot of people aren't, there's a lot of nasty bastards out there.
Yeah.
Who will never change, right?
Yeah.
And it cost me nearly my own life to realize that. So now I don't have trust issues. I've learned to understand different types of people and my radar is very, very tuned in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If it's not too painful to go there, if it is, we will move on. But coming out of that, you know, you've thrown up, you've got rid of the pills, thank God, out of your system. You've had this realisation that, right, I've taken an action, I've made a choice, maybe taken a bit of the control back again.
Yeah.
And how were you feeling at that point? Obviously, a lot of emotion, but what was the sense? Was it relief? Was it I can fight them? You know, what emotion is going through?
It was a myriad of emotions. But the outcome of that was, because I'm such a fighter and I realised what the fuck am I doing? I can fight these bastards. And because I was so partly conditioned that the bank, you'll never win against a bank.
Mm.
But that to me, I reframed as a bully, because it was a bully. Because people who own banks, not all of them, but a lot of them are bullies, right? So when I reframed it as a bully, it was just another opponent for me.
Mm.
When I framed it as an opponent that basically was nowhere near my values and what I've done in my life and the evidence of what I've done in my life, I went all out, I went all in, and I enjoyed it because I had a lot of meaning to it. I was fighting not just for me, I was fighting for not just for my mum, I was fighting for people that had been bullied by that situation.
Yeah, it's a victory for the little guys in life, or your everyday folk that are just trying to kind of do their best to get by versus the big. Yeah. And again, it's that tension between big corporate versus, you know, sort of being in charge of your own life and destiny, right? But I mean, that's amazing. How long was the process in terms of challenging the bank and the whole legal process? Because that must have been
the legal process started in May 2016. It ended in May 2021, 5 years.
Yeah. So during that time, and someone may be going through liquidation, bankruptcy, whatever situation they're going through, and if you're dealing with a legal case, a legal battle, and you've got all the professionals around you, and the lawyers are saying X, Y, Z, and the experts, but it's over 5 years, and you're going to, you know, during that time, resilience, great word, you need a hell of a lot of it. You need a good
dose. That was the number one attribute that I really had to dig deep with, and even bought a few books on resilience, right? Yeah. And I had to fire two sets of lawyers. You know, the lawyers that advised to buy that building that was damaged, they ended up as my lawyers fighting against the building. It was a complete hypocrisy, you know. And they tried to sue me because I wasn't paying them. But eventually I found a really good lawyer, and we did a payment plan. It was we worked it out. But the legal fees alone was nearly £3 million.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm, and in terms of missed opportunities, I lost about 100 million. Because remember, it was my Channel 4 TV show. I gave three houses away to homeless families. I was like on top of the world.
I'm going to come back to that. I want to talk about that in a minute. So, yes, carry on with the resilience piece. The lessons in resilience. What are the top three lessons on building resilience that you learn from that 5-year period of battling with the banks and finally winning?
I think self-worth is number one. You know, you've got to feel you're worthy, that you can fight the evil when you know you're right. Because bullies are very clever these days, and they'll do everything in terms of psychological warfare to make you think you're not good enough to fight them and give up. So self-worth was number one for me. The second thing was intelligence, and is actually researching how strategically you can win. That's a massive part of it. And also, not just that maybe that some people think they're intelligent, some people aren't intelligent, that's a load of bollocks. Everyone's intelligent, but I don't mean intelligence as in a gift. I mean intelligence as in you do the work to learn what you need to do. And the work ethic was definitely part of that. So I could be a lawyer right now because I know all the legal stuff of fighting a case. And it gave me new skills because now I don't get attacked legally because I'm fully protected that way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that was the two things. And then thirdly, I think it was in a way inspirational for me because it gave more meaning to my life, that I wasn't just doing it for me. I was doing it for the greater good.
Mm.
When I framed it like that and empowered myself with that anchored feeling, it made me unstoppable.
Yeah. Purpose. What's your reason why? What's the drive? And like you say, a purpose for a greater good is even more powerful than a purpose just for your own benefit or your family's benefit. Yeah. What's happening with your kids during this time? You know, you've got your kids as presumably teenagers by then.
Yeah, well, they were both living with their mum. My daughter's 27, Sue. My son's 23. So they're not young, but at that time, I guess they were late teens. I mean, they were doing their own thing. They were living with the mum and their stepdad. So they were okay, right? And I didn't want to reveal too much to them emotionally because I don't think they were ready for that. I don't think it was very fair to tell them that at that point. I mean, even when we got divorced, I told the kids, listen, we're getting divorced, but it doesn't mean don't love you. We had a great relationship that way. But they supported me, but they didn't understand the extent of the hole that I was in.
Mm.
I didn't want to worry them by taking them down with me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%.
So I told them after it happened.
Mm.
And they went, oh my God, right? So they learned the lesson by being a little bit disassociated with what was going on with me, because it was my battle, not their battle.
Yeah, fantastic. So I just want to come back to, I want to shift. So, I mean, there's so many brilliant lessons here around, you know, your experience and how that might translate for other people listening. Now, obviously, you've got this amazing ability, right, to connect with people, to sell a dream, to create a business, to get people to back you, to fight the big corporates and the banks, you know, all of that, really, you're kind of selling the whole time, aren't you? You're putting yourself forward to the world, now to the world. So where you are now and the creative side,
right,
because obviously we've got the writing and we've got the two amazing books and the, you know, number one bestsellers, etc., and how that's really become a Bible, that first book for anyone in the sales world. And now we've got the shift into creating incredibly inspiring, you know, the TV show, Get a House for Free on Channel 4, that was massive, and also your shift into Netflix. Yeah. So that was taking a different direction, a more creative direction, shall we say. Now, the link to the Channel 4 show is obviously got a connection with alleviating poverty and, you know, give away the house for free. So what was the bridge that got you into TV?
Actually, that wasn't a move that I made directly to a TV company.
Okay.
So when I wrote my second book, I did a promotion that that someone that bought my book would win a free house, right? Channel 4 TV saw that promotion and contacted me and said, listen, Marco, we love what you're doing. We've seen your story. Would you love to make a TV show with us and give home to a homeless family? And I said, yes, absolutely, right? That's the connection.
Okay, brilliant. So actually, you attracted it to you.
Yes. So I took the risk, you see. One of the lessons in business and life is that you have to take, you have to have courage. You have to be courageously confident and do the things that other people go, fuck me, why did you do that? How did you do that? Because they approached other people that were richer than me, billionaires, and they wouldn't give a house away. They'd give a house rent for a year, and they weren't aligned with that. And they came to me, I wasn't the first on the list, and said, well, what, they did more research and said, okay, this guy fits our kind of profile. And that's how it happened.
Incredible. Wow. I love that. And then the Netflix, right? So co-creator, co-producer. Netflix number two, isn't it, in the US?
Legacy of Lies debuted on Netflix USA at number two in 2021.
Amazing.
Yeah. And there's a story to that, obviously.
Well, would be, wouldn't it, Marco? Come on, let's have it.
Okay. So... going back to when I was a kid, imagining I was James Bond, I'd always wanted to make films, but it kind of life got in the way. And then when I was 45, I said to myself, right, I've done all the things in business I want to do. Now I want to make films. I want to do things for me. I want to be an artist. I want to be on camera. I want to be on the big screen. So I reached out to everyone I knew. I said, listen, I want to make a film. I want to write a script. I need help. Can anyone help me do it? So this woman reached out to me. I'd known on Facebook a few years. We wrote a script together. I sent her 25 grand to start making a film and never saw her again. Now, this is quite common in the film industry, I have to say, right?
Okay.
So anyway, I was obviously burned and I was not happy about that. I was devastated. But I met an actor on that project called Victor Sola. He was a Spanish actor. We became friends. And his best friend was a guy called Adrian Ball, who ended up being the director of Legacy of Lies. And I said, listen, Marco, my friend Adrian is a great director. He's never made a feature. He wants to make his first feature film. He's done lots of MTV stuff and won loads of awards. He'd love to meet you. So I went to Holland and met Adrian. Lovely guy. And we said, right, let's do this. So we started a project, and it was going to be a film based on a true story of how the Russians bombed a building in Kiev in Ukraine in 1999 and killed a lot of Ukrainians, because his wife was Ukrainian and she lost people in that bombing. So I thought, controversial, political, that's going to get a lot of attention as a sales guy, marketing guy, right? So we started marketing, doing the PR for this movie. And I was still living in Malaysia at the time. And Adrian called me one day, said, listen, Marco, are you sitting down? I said, why? He said, sit the fuck down. So I sat down. I said, what's up? He said, your face, your Facebook, your Instagram is all over Russian national news. And I said, that's brilliant PR, man. He said, no, it's not. Because they're circling comments you've made about the president in red, and they're saying on the news station that you're a dead man walking. Now, I didn't believe a word he was telling. They thought he was joking. So I got the newsreel sent to me, and it was true. And I'm going, holy shit. And they're saying on the news, this guy's crazy. He's going to get killed for making this film. And it's the only time I've been truly scared in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Of not actually having a life after this particular moment, right? So I obviously panicked, and I called everyone I knew, including Russian friends I had, and said, listen, what's going on? Am I going to live through this? And the Russian friend said, you'll probably be okay. You'll probably be okay.
I said, probably.
I said, what do you mean, probably? And they said, well, it happens. I said, what do you mean it happens? Well, you know, it happens. You know, it's Russia. So I wasn't feeling too good about, wasn't reassured, right? Now, what I thought was completely disconnected to this time of turmoil was I was speaking to a beautiful Russian woman for about 1 year, met her on Instagram, talking video calls, all the rest of it. And one day she said, Marco, can I come and see you? I'd love to see you. I said, yeah, sure, come over. So she flew to Malaysia, picked her up from the airport. We had 3 days in bed. On the third day, I'm completely naked. And she says to me, Marco, I don't think you should make this film. And I'm looking, why the hell did she say, why did you say that? She says, because I'm not who you think I am. And I said, well, who the hell are you? She said, I'm Russian FSB, and I've been sent here to warn you not to make that film, or we cannot guarantee your safety. Your house is bugged. Your office is bugged. We know what you're doing.
It is like a film in itself, Mark.
So I'm like thinking I'm in Russia, from Russia with love, in bed with a Russian spy. And actually, it's true. So I'm like completely discombobulated, trying to take in this moment. And she continues the monologue. So listen, I travel around the world to sell weapons to different countries. And my best-selling weapon is cyanide, cold dead. And this is a picture of me and my cousin, President Putin. So I'm obviously lying there completely naked and vulnerable, thinking, fuck me, right? But because I've been through so much in my life, I'm thinking to myself, I need to stay cool, right? So it's okay, fair enough. So my strategy was to get her outside in public where I knew where people could see us together. So if anything happened, they knew it was her, right? And it took me 2 days to think about that. And on the second day, I said, listen, Anastasia, because obviously that wasn't a real name. I said, Anastasia, I've had to think about this. And I said, if you wanted to kill me, you would have done it already. Secondly, I've had a fantastic life. I don't give a shit. Kill me. Thirdly, my kids and family said, don't make the film, Dad. So I'm not going to make the film. Don't worry. So strike two, my dream is not possible anymore. And by this time, I spent nearly 100 grand.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So me and Adrian said, let's just cool it for 6 months. So we cooled it for 6 months, and then we wrote another script, a fictional thriller based on the irony of what happened to me, called it Legacy of Lies, right? We got 12 grand together, we made a sizzle reel, and we sent it to film foundations, film grants, film loans, and we won first prize, and we won $1 million grant to make the film. Now, the problem was, because I was going to be the lead actor, the problem was, they said, we can give you the grant, but you're only going to get it if you can get an A-list actor to sign on the project, because I wasn't an A-list actor. So I decided to go to a supporting actor's role, and then we tried to cast Arnold Schwarzenegger, all the big names, and they were $20 million, and they were busy for 10 years anyway, so you couldn't get them, right? So it took us 18 months of casting. It was, like, so hard. And at the very last minute, a guy called Scott Adkins came along, who's probably the best martial arts actor in the world, hands down. I'd never heard of him, but I'd watched his film by chance the year before. I thought, wow, what a great fighter. He dropped out of a film. He said, I love the script. I want to do it. But we had to find 250 grand to put in escrow before he signed. And we didn't have it. So we hustled. And we said, Scott, I can sign on. He signed this letter and we got some money coming in. We got the money. He signed on to the film. And we started filming in July 2019, right? 3 weeks into the project, we ran out of money. So we went to Cannes in France. We got on a friend of a friend of a friend's yacht. We cut some film and we presented the film to investors and we raised another 2 million. And we started again on the project and we finished the project. But in between the project, we got a phone call to my hotel. And they said, Marco, there's someone here to see you. I said, I don't know anybody in Kiev. And they said, well, she knows you. And I went, oh, shit, here we go. I said, put her on the phone. She said, Mark, it's Anastasia. We met in Malaysia. Can you come down, please? So I came down. We had lunch. She said, listen, the reason I'm here is to make sure you're not making the film we discussed. So I'm going to come on the film set. I'm going to talk to all the actors. I'm going to close down the film. You're not going to do it. So nearly strike three, right? I'm not going to make the film anymore. So I stood up and said, listen, go and fuck yourself. You're not telling me to do that. You're not coming anywhere near my film. That's it. And then we never saw each other again. And then we made the film. We finished the film, post-production. We were ready to put it in 10,000 cinemas in December 2019. And then the pandemic came. Couldn't put it in the cinemas, right? Now, the great thing is we had already made money selling the film before it was released pre-sales. So we'd already got the money in the can. And then we had to wait. And then in April 21, we sold the film to Netflix UK, it went to number four. And then we sold it to Netflix USA, and it went to number two in October 21, 2021. And I remember getting the news at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I burst into tears. I threw up three times. It was the best day of my life. Mm. And I ran around my apartment naked all day. It was absolutely freaking amazing. And of course, in between that, I'm like, but also attempting suicide, and there's a Russian spy after me. Oh my God, right?
You couldn't make it up, could you, Marco?
So when that happened, I thought to myself, how can I top this, right? Because I thought, I need to tell my story. And the universe said, why don't you make a musical about your life and the Russian spy and call it Legacy of Spies? And I said, really? And the universe said, yes, really, do it, right? So I said, right, okay, where do I start? So the first thing I thought, I need to be able to sing. So I asked around all my friends, and a lady called Susie Shaw, who was the lead singer of Hearsay, was a friend, and she said, listen, use my vocal coach, you can sing. Now, I didn't believe I could sing. I was told I couldn't sing. I wasn't an actor. I wasn't an artist. I'm crap, right? So I went to get my first lesson. And 18 months later, I'm auditioning for Britain's Got Talent as a singer. So I can sing, right? And then now I've written the first song for the musical, I've got the poster ready, and I'm working on releasing that in the summer of next year.
Oh, excellent. Can't wait. Legacy of Spies. And you kept the name?
Legacy of Spies, yeah.
You heard it here first, folks.
Are you prepared to die to live your dream?
Love it. Love it. You know what? There's so, I mean, obviously you've had a, let's say, colourful life, Marco. A colourful life so far. And, you know, the best is yet to come, I truly believe. You know, you've only just started. But, you know, I think there's so much in here, isn't there, around believing yourself and you can achieve anything. When, you know, when you think you've got it all, you can very quickly lose it all. That's not always in your control. But the action that you take in order to kind of bounce back again and again and again, I think is a common theme for you. And, you know, for other people listening as well, the reinvention of you as again, is stand. I mean, I'm listening as you're telling your story. And that's, to me, it's like, you know, these are the themes that are kind of coming through: reinvention, resilience, the highs and the ultra lows, you know, the betrayal, and then, you know, the belief in yourself and having the right people in your life and all of those good things, but also asking the right questions.
Yes.
And that putting it out to the world, and, you know, stuff will come your way. There's so much in this. And, you know, like you say, you couldn't have made it up, could you?
I mean, I'm like, when I tell the story, even now, I'm like, did that really fucking happen to me?
Do you feel like you're looking in on someone else's life?
That's exactly what it feels like, yeah.
Yeah. I can totally see it. I'm so delighted for you, you know, because you've been through the mill, right, in lots of different ways, not just in one situation in terms of early life, but all the way through there's been challenges and upset and you could have paid the ultimate price in terms of losing your life and taking your life, and thank God you didn't, you know. But, you know, the other thing I wanted to just touch on was the knighthood.
Yes.
Because you are a sir, right?
Sir, not an English sir, though. I'm not an English sir.
Not an English sir. So talk to me about the knighthood, how you got it, what you got it for, and the context of the sir.
Okay. So in about 2015, I became aware I was living in Malaysia, I became aware there was 350,000 blind people that were not allowed guide dogs. And I saw the tragedy of blind people basically being trapped in their own homes, and they can only rely on the family member to take them out. Now, the reason they didn't allow guide dogs was because they didn't allow them in public places because the Muslim religion stigmatized dogs, right? And when I saw that, when I found that out, I couldn't believe what I was seeing, ironically, right? So I thought, what can we do about it? And a friend of mine, Jason Lim, who was a film director, said, listen, why don't we make a film? I said, okay, why don't we call it Are You Blind? Why don't we get a guide dog? Why don't we film the blind man taking the guide dog into public places and getting turned away? And why don't we make it public and send it all over the world? So we bought a guide dog from China for 15 grand, trained the blind man to use the guide dog, filmed the blind man with the guide dog going all over Kuala Lumpur into restaurants, public transport, shopping malls, and being refused. And at one point, we kept going back into the biggest shopping mall in Asia so much that we got held at gunpoint by the security and they took us in the office. But they didn't know that we were filming it. So we put this film together. It was about 15 minutes. And then we put it on Facebook and it got 15 million hits in a week. The world blind community were outraged. And then I got a call from the Prime Minister of Malaysia saying, are you responsible for this film? And of course, I was scared shitless because I mean, it's not my country, right? They could have done anything. They could have, assassinated him somewhere, made it quiet. But they said, listen, first of all, don't worry. Secondly, we were not aware of that problem. And thirdly, thank you so much for bringing it to our attention because now we're going to change the laws to make it legal for blind people to take the guide dogs in public places. And then after that, a myriad of shopping mall managers and people called me and said, we're so sorry. And we changed the rules and that's what happened, right? So that film was literally went bonkers and they said, listen, we want to honor you. So that's how it happened. Now, the actual honor was given to me by an Indonesian state because the word Dato' Seri originated in Indonesia and it was the way of honoring people in the community that did the most charity work. So they gave me Dato' Seri. It happened in Malaysia. So it's called a Commonwealth Knighthood. That's the context of it.
Right, brilliant. But you saw an unjust, unfair situation and wanted to change that. You didn't do it for stardom and anything else. You did it because it was the right thing to do and you made an impact and made a change, right? Which is fabulous. So yeah, you should feel incredibly proud. Because giving back is a big point, isn't it, as well, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just like I saw something that I had the power to do something about because I wasn't afraid. I saw the pain. I went to the houses and saw the pain. I put myself there and I couldn't imagine living like that. So once you have that meaning and purpose behind it, literally anything that you want to do is possible. You just have to have the right meaning behind it and the right purpose and the right reason, you know?
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I'm glad we covered that off because it's an important point. And then, so Marco, before we come to the sort of the final end and last few questions, when you think about your life, and it's been a rich tapestry, shall we say, can you think of the best piece of advice that you've been given?
There's so much. But I'll give you a quote by Thomas Edison, which is, if everyone did what they were capable of doing, they would astound themselves.
Love that. Yes.
And I'll give you another quote. The magic in your life is in the work you're avoiding.
Great. Great question for people. What are you avoiding? Because that's where the magic is. I genuinely believe, Marco, that every single person has greatness in them. I find my purpose is to help others unlock that greatness by, I know it, by being brave, bold, and brilliant. You know, I genuinely believe every single person has that. But sometimes it doesn't come to the surface for a whole bunch of reasons. But that's again, often it's the hidden gems, isn't it?
Well, it is
Hiding.
because if you believe in universe or God or whatever way you frame it, fortune favors the brave, and you have to be the result of the people you're inspiring. You have to be the result of what they want, and it's your responsibility. I think it's your moral obligation to do that in life if you have the power and the resources. You get
Yeah,
what I mean?
100%, 100%. And I'm a big believer in be the change you want to see.
That's it.
you know, and that's obviously a lot of what you've done as well has been very much in that space. So that's fantastic. So you've got an interesting time going on at the moment. And as I say, the best is yet to come, I think, Marco, for you. But if you were to describe this year in a word, what would it be and why?
I would describe this year as growth for me. And the reason I'm saying that is because I'm transitioning from an entrepreneur to an artist, although it's the same thing in a lot of ways. But for me, I've had to grow and believe that I could be a songwriter, believe I could be a singer, believe that I could be a star on stage. And for me, that's a journey I've had all my life. But now, this year, it was more acute because I had more meaning. It had a story that I needed to tell. Do you know what I mean? So there was more of a deadline to that. Mm. And the universe keeps telling me, tell your freaking story, but do it in a musical way that everyone understands it. You know? Yeah.
Brilliant. Growth, I love that. So Marco, where can people find you? If they want to connect, they want to sort of engage you, whether it's coaching, whether it's on the more artistic side,
I'm currently being held in Moscow at the Russian FSB headquarters. I'm not allowed to leave the country. No, I'm joking.
I know it's a lie, you films though.
Yeah, well that was a cover. That's my cover story. You go to my Instagram, Marco Robinson Now. It's got a blue tick, so you know it's me. That's where you can reach me, really. That's the best place.
Brilliant. And you're also on LinkedIn, aren't you? Because I know we've
connected. All social media platforms, but Instagram's the one that my go-to.
The big one for you. Brilliant. Fantastic. So I'd encourage everyone to reach out to you, find out what's going on in your world, and watch this space for that incredible musical. Can't wait for that. So, Marco, Brave, Bold, Brilliant, what does it mean to you?
Well, it says it all in those three words, doesn't it? But it's actually, when you have something that you can't deny, when you have something that lights you the fuck up and you keep suppressing it because you think you can't do it, because you're conditioned not to do it, because you think it's silly, and it keeps coming back up again, you have got to be brave to dive into that and realize it's going to save your life and make your life, right? And the bold piece is being upfront about it and owning it and saying, I can do this. And the brilliant part of it is learning how to be good at doing it, learning how to better at doing it, leaning into learning from people that have already got what you want. That's how you become brilliant. You don't do it on your own. You never do it on your own. You always have a guide, and you have to lean into that guide, and you have to read books by those guides and realize that people have done this before you. The evidence is there. All you have to do is learn that blueprint.
Fantastic. What a brilliant way to end. Thank you, Marco. I can't wait to see what's next. And honestly, thank you for speaking so openly and just being authentically you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jeanette.
I really hope you've enjoyed Brave, Bold, Brilliant. Don't forget to subscribe and share with all your friends. And if you've enjoyed listening, I'd love it if you'd leave me a 5-star review.